Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is the founder of the tech review website, Jim Tanis. Jim, welcome.
Thanks, John. It's great to finally be with you.
It's great to have you on the show because you are an awesome technical person and you have developed this awesome site called Tech Review. And you're also a regular contributor to the Mac Observer. And before that, you were an Apple Genius. Oh, my God. Oh, my. So much to talk about.
Yeah, and indeed. Hopefully we can thread some interesting stories here.
Okay, cool. Well, I want to talk to you about your interests when you were younger, because that always sets the stage for a person's career. When we get to be our age, we kind of look back and say, you know, what did we do? What were we aspiring to? So tell me about that when you were younger.
Yeah, I was always interested in computers and technology. I didn't have any type of family interest. Like, my parents weren't engineers or computer scientists or anything, but it just always fascinated me. And my school, I went to a private school in Buffalo, New York called Elmwood Franklin for kindergarten through fourth grade. And they were one of the schools that participated with Apple back in the day in terms of getting Macs, or not Macs, at that point it was just Apple IIs, into the classroom. And so that was really my first experience. We didn't have a computer at home until I was 7 or 8. And using those Apple IIs, which at that point...
Wait, let me get this straight. You were 7 years old and you were using an Apple II.
Yes. Well,
I was going to ask you if you were born with a single board computer in your crib, but, you know.
No. I definitely had an interest from as far back as I can remember, but no, it was the Apple II in our classrooms that was really my first hands-on experience.
You know, so many guests have told me that. Probably 3/4 of the people I've talked to on this show tell me that they started with an Apple II. It's amazing.
Well, it was a great program by Apple back then. It was very forward-thinking. It didn't save them in terms of, you know, the downturn of the company in the 90s, but it ingrained in a lot of people of, I guess, my age, roughly, that you know, this was a very interesting, it was our first experience with the computers. It was our first time getting our hands on this kind of wondrous, mysterious box. And there was so much software, educational software, entertainment stuff, and it really was the entry point for so many people. And so that's why I was excited when Apple a few years ago started trying to get iPads in the classroom. Mm-hmm. Although now it looks like it's all going the way of Chromebooks. But, you know, getting kids that first experience, that's very important. And I was very lucky that was an opportunity for me back then.
Did your love for the Apple II extend to your curriculum in high school and college?
No, not directly. My path to where I am now has been kind of meandering. I kind of went through academia with the intention of becoming an attorney, like my father. That's where the kind of the family influence comes in. Mm. And so I did take some classes in middle school. I was part of a sort of an informal group that we kind of worked on BASIC with one of the professors or one of the teachers there. So I learned BASIC, and I took some C++ courses and some Java courses. But I never got into programming, never got into electrical engineering or IT, you know, areas of education. I did basically the history and political science track that a lot of attorneys or future lawyers follow. And so that's really what I focused on. My electives in high school were history, I was in student government in high school, things like that. Got to college, majored in history and political science. And that's really where it took me, all the way up through law school. I went to law school. But at that point, that's the point where my life really, my notions I had held my whole life really became unavoidable. I thought I was going to be a lawyer. I thought that was my path. And I realized in law school that I hated it.
What kind of law were you thinking about studying? Defense or prosecution or contract or patents?
Corporate law. I didn't have the technical degrees to really excel in patent work, although if I had, that probably would have been where I would have gone to. But it was my father was a corporate attorney, so I started down that path. But I never took the bar, never practiced.
Was there an event or a professor that caused you to second think this?
Well, I don't want to... I don't want to put someone in a negative light, but there was a period that would have been my second semester of my second year that I realized I wasn't really enjoying this. I had a couple professors that I didn't click with. I saw as my classmates and I were gearing up for summer internships, I saw the way that some of them behaved and how they viewed their profession.
Wow. And you're the second attorney candidate who's told me that.
Wow.
They looked around and I forget who it was, but one of my previous guests was talking about how they were at a copy machine and trying to run off some notes and had a very bad experience with some people who were very rude. And he looked all around himself and he saw people that were really kind of awful.
Well, I don't want to paint. I mean, I had wonderful classmates, and the legal profession, for all the flack it gets, is very important. There's a lot of people who abuse it and abuse, you know, the spirit of the law and what it's for. But lawyers and legally minded people are part of what keeps this country on the right track. You know, the Electronic Frontier Foundation and, sure. and organizations like that. That's vitally important. And so I don't want to trash law or trash lawyers. But for me, I found out at that point that wasn't what I wanted to do. And it also happened to coincide with my wife, who was getting her master's in architecture, which is what she did want to do, finding a job in Washington, D.C. and moving. And so I walked away from law. We moved to Washington, D.C. And I started working for Apple while here as a sort of a part-time job in Cincinnati. And then we moved to D.C. and I went full-time with Apple. And that's how I sort of...
You worked in an Apple store, right, as a genius?
Yes, yes, exactly.
How did you get that job? I think a lot of people would be curious about the process. Because you had a law degree and not a PhD in electrical engineering.
Well, they were from... It does vary by store. And again, and also this happened probably 7-8 years ago, so I'm sure things are different now. But at the time, they were less interested in your, you know, printed resume as opposed to your sort of on-site interview, which was a group interview. And they put us through mock sales procedures, mock support procedures, asked us about the products, asked us to explain why certain products, certain services were good or bad, and it was just a familiarity.
They wanted to see if you could engage with a customer without yelling at the customer.
Exactly. Yeah, it was definitely as much of a technical evaluation as a psychological evaluation. And so it was great. I connected with the people who were conducting that interview, and they called me back. I think that was the next day, and this was just for a part-time specialist job, which is at the time, I don't know if they still call it that, but specialists were the ones who do their sales and then like mobile support. And when I went to D.C., I transitioned to the genius side of things there. So having that specialist part-time job really helped with the procedure in D.C. I don't know if I would have gotten the job applying from scratch or something like that. So
every day you're behind the beautiful hardwood, and every day people come in with a phone or a Mac that has some sort of problem, and you have to kind of deal with it. Tell me about that. And do you have any interesting stories to tell without being too specific?
And again, so this is all, keep in mind, this is all years ago. Mm-hmm. But it was my particular store, which was the Clarendon store in Virginia, right there in Arlington, just a great environment, really good people. We were very busy being a you know, metropolitan store. And it was very challenging because every problem was unique, and we had very little time to address or to dedicate to each problem. They allotted 15 minutes, but if you hit the 15 minutes and you weren't done fixing this person's issue, things got a little complicated. But it was rewarding.
Tell me about that complication. Was it? Did you get like a write up, or you get verbally scolded, or?
Well,
how was that like?
Apple's funny. They so like when the iPad first launched, we were so busy that I'm talking about the very first iPad in 2010. We were very, very busy, and people were coming in, and Apple had no queue management system. How do we help? We have only a certain number of staff, both for support and sales, and we have X number of customers, and that customer number exceeds the staff. What do you do? And so our, I can't remember what they called it, concierge. There was a person who was an employee whose role was sort of to help people find what they were looking for. He just on his own got his iPad and made a little list in the Notes app and just kept track of customers as they came in and called them out, called out. And it was a nice flow. People understood the process. But then one of our regional managers got wind of it and said, well, we don't have lines in our store. We don't do that. And it was just an instruction not to do that anymore without any type of guidance.
But they do. When I walk into a store now, the first thing they do is ask my name and put me in. Guy types into an iPad.
Exactly. And that my understanding is they have since adopted a formal queue system. But at the time, it was just, don't do that. But there was no instruction on what we were supposed to do. So it was just this very sort of, if we don't acknowledge
it's Apple, everything
it's
has to go well.
Exactly.
So if you got behind, was it something you could recover from, or did they track you so closely that every little extension over 15 minutes was a hard headache for you?
I mean, we always recovered, and we always got through it. And whether it was staying open later or having some people come back from break early or whatever, we got through it, but it was a very stressful time, just because Apple hadn't quite figured out what they wanted to do with retail support. They were using the model that they used, in the early years of the 2000s, at a time when their popularity had exploded and they were doing 10 times the traffic, and they hadn't really updated that model to suit that new that increase in traffic, which. It appears, like I said, the last few years, they've really seems to have gotten it sorted out.
If I may, I'd like to ask you a genius-type question. When people brought their equipment in for attention, would you attribute that to the complexity of the product, or would you attribute that to the lack of customer understanding of modern technologies, or both?
Well, I mean, it really was both. It would depend on the service call. We'd had some people come in and they just, like when the iPad did launch, we had lots of customers who came in very upset that their Mac software would not run on the iPad. And they just did not understand that this was a different operating
system.
Really?
I've never heard that.
Yeah, it was very confusing. It was something similar to what Microsoft went through when they launched their first generation Surface tablet, because it was running one variant of the tablet ran Windows RT, which was ARM based and did not run legacy x86 apps. And so you had lots of customers not understanding that and trying to use old software, and it wouldn't work. It was the same thing. It was very confusing. And at the same time, on the other side of things, you'd have customers come in whose only exposure had been an iPhone or an iPad. And they would sit there at an iMac on display and paw at the screen and then tell us it was broken because it wasn't the touch wasn't working.
Oh, really? Really? Mm-hmm. Seriously?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not every customer, but we had, far more than one would do that. Because you think about it, you've got somebody who's not into this. They don't watch keynotes. They don't follow Apple, the Mac Observer. And they get an iPad, and that's their first Apple product. They're husband or wife or child or whatever gets them an iPad for Christmas and they love it, and then they go and they say, well, maybe I want something bigger, I want like a Mac, and they walk in and they see a very similar interface in terms of like launchpad
icons.
And they go and they touch it because that's what they know, that's how they're interacting with this quote
that's
Apple
that's
device.
Amazing. Did Apple managers ask you for feedback? For example, you're a genius, you're on the front lines, you see this every day. Do they ever call you up or have a meeting and say, what's the most common consumer mistake made or misperception or meme?
No, not our store managers. They were much more focused on like the logistical operations of the business of the store, but very, very very infrequently, I should say, you know, once or twice a year, there would be email surveys or visits from Apple corporate representatives, and we would sort of get into that. It would be a combination of things like traditional HR issues from the employee's perspective, but then there'd always be some segment about what can we do better. At the time I was working, the big thing was business. How can we reach out to businesses? How are customers coming in for support who are business people, business owners, business managers? How are they experiencing their Apple products, and how could we change either what we make or how we sell it and market it to suit them better? So there were like I said, infrequent attempts to poll the employees for that kind of information.
That's a gold mine of information, I think. I think if I were a regional manager, I'd be wanting to hear all that I could about those kinds of events, people pawing at displays or trying to install Mac apps on their iPad. That's just an amazing story. Cool. Mm-hmm. Do you have any more?
Well, I mean, there were just lots of interesting characters. Being in D.C.
Did anybody ever come in and camp out? Like, were there people who were like such big fans that they would just come and sit there all day?
We had to kick them out. We had a couple people come in, and I think they must have worked at like the Crate and Barrel, or there was another retail store nearby, and they would come in every single day it must have been on their lunch break, and they would sit and watch YouTube or just kind of hang out. But I think that was less about being a fan and wanting to be surrounded by the experience and the brand, and more just saying, hey, there's free internet over here. And then we had our product lines, you know, I was in Virginia for the launch of the second gen iPad, and there was a line that went around the block, and that was cool. Cool to see, you know, they're very excited customer base. And I was in Cincinnati for the launch of the iPhone 4, and that was a complete and total disaster because, as you recall, the online reservation, that was before we knew about AntennaGate, The online reservation system like screwed up, and they didn't allocate enough units to those who had reserved online. And so we had two lines of people, one who had reservations, one who were walk-ins, and we didn't have enough supply for both. And they all were very upset, and we were there all day, and you know, people were waiting 7 hours in line. So kind of saw both sides of that, the good and the bad of queuing for Apple products.
Did you have to come in on Sunday afternoons and then have big meetings and prep and put up displays and work all Sunday evening and then get up at 5 o'clock on Monday morning for the big event or whenever it was? Did that really happen?
Mm-hmm. They have, I can't remember, there was a word for it. It escapes me right now, but there was a word for those events where before a product was set to launch and they had to change over all the signage and mm-hmm. put the new products on display. It would pretty much be an all hands on. We'd get there we'd stay at the end of that previous day. We'd be there not all night, but till, you know, probably 10 or 11, and we'd get everything in order, and then we'd all go home and come back the next morning. And it was not too bad, and it was fun because, you know, at least again, each store is different, but the managers in my store would put on music and they'd have refreshments for the staff. And
did they bring in pizza?
Yeah, it was pizzas and you know, bagels and pretzels and snacks and stuff like that. So it was not a terrible burden, unless you just really had something else to do.
Okay, cool. Well, that's enough of that. There's some things I want to ask you about in terms of modern Apple technology and Mac Mini and Mac Pro and some other geeky stuff. But we'll get to that in the second half of the show. Right now, we need to take a break, Jim. So we're going to hear from Kelly. We'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us, folks.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm talking to the founder of Tech Review website, Jim Tanis, former Apple genius and all-around Apple expert. So when you left Apple, I think the first time I knew about you was you were writing for the Mac Observer as Mac Geek Gab Jim. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I was... Okay, so here's the dirty secret. I started writing for TMO before I had officially left Apple, which is a big no-no. So I had an alias, MGG Jim, for Mac Geek Gab Jim.
Did anybody figure out who you were?
No, it never came up, which meant just either I didn't offend the right people or I was just I was too unimportant to bother with. So,
well, what the back story here on this is that there would be the Sunday night Mac Geek Gab with Dave Hamilton and John Brown, of course, and they've done thousands of episodes. I don't even know how many they've done, but typically there would be more details, reader, listener questions to answer, and then you would kind of follow up and explain in a column some of the more technical details that listeners raised during Mac Geek Gab. Is that right?
Yeah, that's about right. I had been a long time listener to the Mac Geek Gab podcast and had actually written in a few questions just as a listener for Dave and John to figure out. And to their credit, they got the answer right on both the things I wrote in. So that was good. And then as I knew my time with Apple was going to be winding down, I reached out to Dave just out of the blue and said, hey, I'm a listener. I've written before. Do you want any writers? Can I help, write any content? And then he kind of set me up with this written form of the show.
Yeah.
And then it kind of expanded from there. And I over time went from writing just those Mac Geek Gab articles to product reviews and news and sort of became a part-time staffer for probably a couple years, if you add it all up.
Yeah, you've written some great technical stuff for the Mac Observer. We really appreciate that. You are so technically deep on not only Mac, but iOS and Linux, and you even know Windows better than all the rest of us combined.
Well, I just have poor judgment, so I'm using Windows, and you're just not. You guys got it sorted out, so you're not in that boat.
So what inspired you to start your own technical website? It's called techreview.com.
Mm-hmm. And I had been writing for Mac Observer for a while, and we had just moved and just had our first child, my wife and I, we'd moved to Erie, Pennsylvania. She gave birth. I was a new parent, new house, and I wanted a little bit more flexibility, both in terms of my time as well as in terms of content. I wanted to write more than just Mac. I wanted to cover Windows. I wanted to cover PC hardware. I wanted to cover gaming. And obviously those are topics that they're just not suitable for Mac Observer. That's not their area of focus.
Right.
And so I investigated what it would take to start my own site and went out, and apparently it's the big secret is it's not that hard to at least to get it going, to buy a web address and to register as a business.
Did you start it with zero funding?
I had support from a few, I would call them angel investors.
Oh, excellent.
That level, not officially, but they would have been that level of if you were officially seeking capital, it would be on that level. So friends and families and colleagues. And they helped me kind of put the upfront cost. But there's not a lot of overhead for a small site starting out. Nowadays, I've got big bandwidth bills, but at the start, it's not too bad. But they kind of helped me sustain myself through the period when it wasn't making any money, because as an ad revenue based site, you don't make any money at first when you have no traffic. But
for the listeners who are not quite familiar with Tech Review, here's your chance to beat your chest. So tell me, what is Tech Review? What's its charter? What's its focus? What are you trying to accomplish there?
Well, so Tech Review, and I just want to clarify too, it's spelled a little differently because domain names are all taken these days. So it's TechReview.com. Mm-hmm. And it started, my goal initially, and this would have been early 2013, was something like the Mac Observer, but focused on everything else, like not just Mac and Apple, but Windows, Microsoft, all that stuff. So I had news coverage, I had product reviews, I had analysis, financial tracking, you know, like what are these companies doing, what are their financial reports.
Sounds like a lot of work to do alone.
Have you exactly
brought people in over the years?
Well, I do have some great contributors, but I never had the resources at that point to bring on a full-time employee or even a part-time employee to help with that. And so I became quickly overwhelmed and realized I could not be. You know, the Mac Observer is a group of how, I mean, you've got at least five core people plus another five or seven, you know, on top of that contributing occasionally. So it's a big operation. That level of detail that they do there, I could not do on my own. So I kind of retooled the site. We even did a little bit of a redesign after getting some early feedback from readers. And I focus now, or since then, I've been focusing on pretty much tips and tutorials, product reviews, things like that, occasional editorials. But the focus of the site is not trying to keep up with the news, trying to keep up with the latest stock analysis and all that. It's about helping people figure out what is going on with their computer, whether it's a Mac or a Windows PC or a game console or whatever, providing the tips and tutorials and reviews for that level. It's a more novice audience, although we do occasionally cover some pretty advanced stuff. But it's really taking my experience at Apple, where I was helping people who were confused sort this all out. I really like that, and so that's really the focus now. It's about, again, just helping people sort their way through these problems with machines they don't necessarily understand.
One of the articles that you wrote that I will never forget was your scathing review of the 2014 Mac Mini. Did you ever get any sense that Apple was paying attention to that? Did it make enough waves that you think maybe you had an influence? And what do you think of the future of the Mac Mini?
Well, I doubt Apple cared if they saw it, but it was a very highly trafficked article. It was one of my top articles that year. In fact, that year, it was probably the top article by traffic. So it got comments from both sides. It got comments from people saying right on, and it got comments from people saying you're an idiot. You don't know what, you know, how dare you try to tell a multi-billion dollar company what to do. So, which, fair enough. But Apple hasn't done anything with the Mini to make me believe that they're, if they did read that or read similar takes on the situation, that they're listening, because they really haven't changed the Mini. They haven't updated it since then.
Do you think they will?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's still the entry level Mac. It's still the cheapest way to buy a Mac, at least new from Apple. So it's an important product in that regard. And you look at what they're doing with the MacBook Air, which ironically is now the thickest Mac, or at least Mac notebook. And they're keeping it around because of its price point, because of its popularity, or at least name.
And for education, too.
And exactly, and education has an impact there, although I don't know how many MacBook Airs Apple is selling direct into the education market.
I think they are.
Okay. So, I mean, it's there. They have no reason to kill it unless the parts that are in it become too much trouble to procure. But it's a product that is missing out on what on so much more than it could be, because there was a generation there, the 2012 era Mac Mini, where it was powerful. It started at a lower price with lower performance, but if you wanted, you could put some pretty powerful components in there, and it could be a great server. And it was the perfect form factor. It could be a great home theater PC, and they decided to solder the RAM in 2014. They decided to go with low power processors, which cap out at 2 cores, 4 threads, and no discrete graphics. And
why low power on a device that you have AC power on the desk?
Yeah, and you know, when they released it, they talked about how they cut the idle power in half from the previous gen, from 10 to 5 watts. And to an individual, that's no big deal. That's pennies on the year. But to an enterprise, to any type of organization deploying thousands of these things, I can see how that could add up. But again,
server room heat.
Yeah, but again, you're not going to be using these in servers because they're not powerful enough. They're not. They don't justify the cost for the power you're getting. Yeah. And so it is really confusing. I mean, at this point, again, I think, who knows? Because, you know, they did surprise us with the iMac Pro, but
maybe it was one of those items that was cut at the WWDC keynote, you know, during John Gruber's the show. Federighi and Schiller, I forget which one, mentioned that the first cut of the keynote was 3.5 hours. Maybe the new Mac Mini was something they had to cut, and we'll see it in a few months.
Maybe, although my understanding of that comment was like they cut the stuff that they released anyway, like the talking. They usually do 20 minutes at the beginning and talking about, you know, traffic at the stores,
yeah,
and
the updates,
number of Macs.
Yeah.
I think it was more that kind of stuff. But it is the cheapest way to buy a Mac. That is still important to them, and it's obviously not costing them too much to keep it around as it is.
As an Apple genius former, how do you perceive a customer coming into an Apple store in 2017 and looking around and seeing a Mac Mini connected to maybe a old Apple Cinema display or an LG? I don't know what they're connecting it to these days. Do you think customers pay attention to the age of the product? Or would somebody walk into an Apple store and say, oh, Mac Mini, yeah, it's got to be the best. It's from Apple. I'll take one of those. They get it home and they realize it's 3 years old.
Well, a customer who's going to buy a Mac Mini in an Apple store is probably not going to know about the age. And Apple is very tricky in that regard because if you notice, they don't, when they advertise the specs of their hardware, they don't give you the full product number. They don't say this is a Core i7-7700K in the iMac. They say Core i7 at 3.4 gigahertz or whatever it is. And so that right there doesn't help the customer distinguish in their distinguish generations. And there's a huge gap in performance and capability between the i7s and i5s of various generations. So
Apple still has that good, better, best mentality.
Exactly. And to be fair, again, if you're buying a Mac Mini, if you're saying I'm going to buy a $500 Mac and I'm going to buy it in the store, like I don't have some already lined up usage for it, you're probably not going to notice. You're probably not going to care because you're not going to be rendering 3D graphics and you're not going to be assembling feature length movies in Final Cut.
Gravitational wave simulations.
Right. You're going to be using Photos and Safari and the calendar app. And you know, and it's fine. It is fine for that. That was the biggest criticism of my article on the Mac Mini by people who disagreed was that it's fine. And it is. It is fine. My point was not that it's not fine. It's that it could be so much more. And it's frustrating that it's not.
It depends on how you say fine. You know, you could say, yeah, it's fine.
Yeah, that's true.
Or you could say, it's fine. So, all right, so let's move on. The recent WWDC keynote gave us great hope that Apple's back on track with the Mac. And we just released all new iMacs, new MacBook Pros, revised the MacBook and the MacBook Air, and gave us a glimpse of the iMac Pro. And they're still committed to, as they've discussed a couple months ago, the Mac Pro. How are you? Has your feelings about what the Mac Pro might be like changed after this WWDC keynote?
No, not really. I mean, I think that they were very clear when they kind of issued their Mac Pro mea culpa to Gruber and, you know, that group a few months ago or whenever it was. I think they understood that, you know, they can't apply the iMac or previous gen Mac Pro philosophy to this one going forward if they want it to succeed. So I'm expecting something modular in the sense that it's upgradable, expandable, does not have a built-in display, can support different types of graphics cards, has perhaps multi-processor options, lots of internal storage. So I don't think it's really the iMac Pro's introduction doesn't really change what I'm expecting that they are hoping that they'll do with the Mac Pro. But it was surprising to see them, you know, go all out on the iMac Pro. I mean, we had heard rumors that it would be Xeon based, but I was thinking Xeon E3, which is sort of the desktop equivalent, 4-core part, not necessarily going to the E5 line, which it looks like they haven't clarified exactly what part's going in this, but it, based on the core range, it looks like it's going to be the E5 2600 series when that's released later this
How
year.
How much memory do you recall an E5 2600 can access?
Oh, it can access terabytes. I mean, that's a limitation of the chipset and the operating system. So they're not anywhere near that limitation
in this one. Excellent. Yeah. Because I expect that the Mac Pro will go even beyond the iMac Pro in terms of memory. 256, maybe even a terabyte of RAM if you want to. I mean, yeah. Apple's pulled out the stops now, so I expect there to be few complaints about the power of the Mac Pro.
Yeah, I mean, my view on Apple right now in terms of the Pro market is they do not deserve in any way, shape, or form the benefit of the doubt. The release of the iMac, or the announcement of the iMac Pro was a good first step. Mm-hmm. But after they have screwed up that part of their business for so many years, ignored it and made stupid decisions and been very smug and arrogant about their failings when they were happening, when other people were telling them this, and they said, no, Phil Schiller said, you know, whatever, we can't innovate my ass.
We spent at this. Years working on the touch bar, millions of dollars. Yeah. It's great.
So I'm happy to see them take this turn, but they have to put up or shut up. The iMac Pro has to come out, first of all, and be what they promised. And then they have to come out with this Mac Pro and not only announce something that's intriguing and can be useful to professionals, but then they have to support it. Yeah. They can't just release it and let it go for 3 years.
Right. So we have to keep track of this and let them prove themselves now. So.
Yeah,
the early arrival of MacBook Pros with Kaby Lake, that's a good sign. They didn't wait.
Exactly. They did not wait again for so long. And that was a little tricky because of Kaby Lake's timing for the introduction and their timetable for the Skylake MacBook Pros they released last year. But it is good to see them not rest on that and take the initiative.
Well, we're almost out of time. I have time for one last question for you. Had to skip over some items, but I wanted to ask you about this. Apple made a big deal about AR, augmented reality. You know, the virtues of virtual reality and headsets and goggles and 3D immersion are obvious. But do you have any thoughts on where Apple's going with AR and its durability?
Well, I think that they think it's going to be the thing. I mean, Tim Cook was close to a year ago now, but Tim Cook was giving an interview on one of the TV shows, and he said AR was the future. And I agree with him because at a sufficiently advanced level of technology, AR can also do VR. It can black out the headset and completely immerse you in a virtually projected world. So, you know, if you're going to invest in one platform, AR seems to be the way to go.
Is it mostly games, or does augmented reality have positive signs for how we interact with our phones and our iPads and our Macs?
Well, that's the other thing too, is so right now VR is mostly focused on games, at least in terms of a percentage of its adoption. It's all about games and entertainment, whereas AR is primarily, the applications that are out for it now are primarily educational and interaction, things that allow you to visualize data, visualize math problems and physics problems. So AR is more up Apple's alley in terms of having much more of a productivity educational benefit than purely VR at this stage.
Excellent.
Excellent. So I'm excited. Plus, you know, they did it right too. At least as right as Apple can do something like this, they put sufficiently powerful GPUs in their standard iMacs, for both the iMacs and the notebooks, they're pursuing this external GPU thing, which has been going on in the PC world for a couple of years now, but this will allow when it's fully baked, will allow a user who has a MacBook or who has a lower end iMac to go out and add that high performance GPU if they want to either create or consume VR or AR content.
Right. I'm happy to see Apple doing this. This is great.
Yeah.
Well, we are out of time now, actually. So I want to thank you very much for being on the show. It's been a grand tour. Thanks for telling us your story and how you got into all of this and chatting with me about Apple. It's been great. So thanks for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me, John.
If the listeners want to contact you, tell them how they can do that.
Well, you can find me writing every day at techreview.com. Again, that's TEKREVUE.com. I also these days am writing, contributing to PC Perspective, which is a website focused on PC hardware. So if you're kind of interested in exactly how well that RX 580 GPU and the new iMac is going to perform, well, they've got reviews on the hardware here over at PCPer.com. So check that out. And you can find me on Twitter. It's MGGJim, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show.
Cool. I'll put those all in the show notes. Okay. Well, that's got to wrap it up. Listeners, thanks for coming by. I hope you enjoyed the show with me and Jim. And come back and see us again next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.